I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
What's up, Tommy? How are you, dude?
You're really good, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well, man. Yeah, really well. All things considered, keeping my head above water in these times. I'm actually reading your book for
The I Chung. Yeah,
for entertainment, and it's pretty amazing, man. I mean, this is a recount of your time in jail for selling bongs, which I'm sure we'll talk about. If it's all right with you, I want to read you a passage from my book, which I put out last year, which is based on conversations from this podcast. And one of the sections is on basically the people who are in the books, their heroes. And this is Be Real, good friend of yours, talking about you and your connection. I'd love to read this to you to start us off. So B says, In the world of cannabis and activism within that world, Tommy Chong is definitely my mentor. I've often told him that. He was the one showing us how to freedom fight. Him and Jack Herer, rest his peace, taught me a lot about the cannabis world, about the hypocrisy that exists within mainstream culture, and the reasons why it's been kept back for so long. I think Jack would be really proud to see how much more educated people are about cannabis culture nowadays and all the politics around it. Tommy and I have been very good friends for many years now, and we've done each other many favors and worked together on many things, and it's always cool catching a smoke with him. I watch what he's doing in the cannabis industry, and I really believe he deserves all the success and opportunities being afforded to him. He's put in the work and even served as a martyr when the government made an example of him by putting him in jail for the amount of time that they did. He didn't bitch and cry about it either. He served his time like a man, and he did it for his son, so his son wouldn't have a mark on his record or his life. Tommy didn't have to do that, but he took it upon himself to do it, and my respect for that man is beyond words. And then he goes on to talk about
that's very
thing,
sweet.
Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah, very nice. Very nice. Well, Be Real is a good guy, you know, no doubt about it.
It's funny because obviously the name, it took me, you know, many years for the penny to drop because it's right there in plain sight. Be Real, of course.
Yeah.
And if ever there was like an embodiment of that concept, it's that dude right there, isn't it?
Well, you know, the cannabis, it helps us be real. You know, it makes the truth so important, regardless of, you know, the implications or whatever, you know. And that's what happened with me when I went to jail. I could have wiggled my way out of it, you know, but they wanted me in there. And when the government wants you, you know, that's what my lawyer friend, not the lawyer I hired, but the lawyer across the street, wasn't getting paid. He told me what to do. He said, go do your time, you know, and move on with your life. He said, by the time you appeal and do all that crap, you know, you could have served your time. And so I did that. And I also turned it into a religious retreat. I think I told you that the last time we were on. And going, not so much religious as much as spiritual, you know, because that's what's got me to where I am today. And that's what keeps me going, you know, because I've been privy to a lot of truth that have always been available to us. But it just seems that people aren't ready, you know, because we're all in a learning stage, you know. I've been reading. Now, what I've been doing in between podcasts is catching up on my reading. I got a stack of books that people sent me, you know, that I haven't got around to reading it, because I had trouble for a minute, but I found some glasses that work, kind of work. And so I've been catching up on my reading, and I really enjoy living, put it that way.
Well, that's all there is, right? And yeah. if you're not engaged in the experience of it and the process of it, then, you know, what are you doing with this time, which is so precious? As you know, like when you're in jail, and I have it's a loose tangent, but go with me on this. So in 2013, I broke my spine and I had to spend 3 months basically doing what's called conservative treatment, where I lay flat on my back in bed. I couldn't roll over or sit up or leave the bed. So I had 3 months to just lie there and meditate and think. And, you know, in the similar sense, you had 9 in jail. When you're in prison, when you're serving time, all you have is time, right? And so it's how you use that time, which, you know, is the make or break in terms of how you're going to get through that experience and what you're going to get out of that experience.
Well, what I did, as soon as I got there, my brother-in-law sent me the I Ching, you know, the Book of Changes. And the first, when I threw the coins and I came to my chapter, the first line says, you are in jail for a reason. You are in prison for a reason. Now, you know, it's a book.
You know? Yeah, written thousands of years ago, right?
Book of Changes, yeah, 2,000 years ago. And all of a sudden, it's telling me, you are in jail for a reason. So right then, I knew I was on to something. And then it went on to say that prisons are penitentiaries are there for people to change their behavior. Now, I love that line, because it doesn't anything right or wrong, good or bad. It just said, you're there to change your behavior. And I thought about that, and I said, yeah, I have. I will change my behavior. Because for a while there, I was kind of playing with the metaphysical world, you know, touching on it, reading it every once in a while, go to it at times. But I was busy being young and being, you know, doing what people do. But when I went to prison, I had, like you say, you got time. And when I was in there, I made friends. Of course, I ended up with a dog. That's your best guy that you hang with the whole time you're there. And he had been in prison all his life. In fact, prison to him was like part of his routine. You know, he would be out for a while, then he'd get caught, then he'd go to prison, then he'd, and it was always the minimum security, because he taught me, you know, that, you know, how to keep your nose clean and stay out of trouble and take advantage of the situation.
Is this the guy, Steve, who you talk about in your book?
Yeah, that's Steve. That's
one of my favorite little observations quickly, Tommy, is when you talk about, say, his first wife, I guess, was called Ruth. And then when she leaves him, he changes the tattoo to Ruthless, which I just thought was the perfect joke. Like, that's just, you can't write that, can you?
Isn't it Ruthless? Yeah. That's Steve. Yeah. Well, he showed me, you know, he just showed me, you know, he had larceny. He was like, he was not rehabilitated in any sense of the word. And what he would do, he would game the system, of course, you know. I, on the other hand, what I wanted to do, I wanted to be the most the A student in prison, you know. I couldn't snitch because everybody was trying to snitch on me, so there was no one there, and my sentence wasn't long enough that it would make any difference.
Yeah.
You know, although they tried, the prison tried to turn me into a snitch, you know, because the first time I had a chance to make a telephone call, I phoned home, you know, it had been 2 weeks without talking to my wife, you know, which was incredible because I had talked to her every day since we've been together, every day for years and years, and not having conversation with her for 2 weeks seemed like an eternity. And so when we're talking on the phone, she says, "How's it going?" And I told her, "Well, you know, I'm making for everybody likes me because I'm who I am." And I says, and I said, even a guard came in my cubicle and we chatted, you know, and so I never thought anything of it. I forgot that they listened to all the phone calls. And not only listen to it, but they do it with a computer. So if you hit certain words, it raises a red flag. And so within minutes, about an hour after I hung up, I get called into what they call control, you right. know, where they're everything's there. And I had to sit with the Gestapo. There was like the prison secret police. Yeah, and they actually wore long Gestapo coats, you know,
like black leather jackets.
Yeah, they actually wore that. They looked the part and they wore the part. And so they asked me. They said, "Well, who's this guard that was in your cell or in your cubicle?" And I said, "Well, I never got his name. I did, but I don't know. Just a guard. What'd he look like?" I said, "Well, he had a guard outfit on, you know, and
as vague as possible." Yeah.
Yeah. And so they were really interested if I was going to snitch. And had I snitched on the guard, I would have been busy, very busy. But of course I didn't. And as soon as they saw that I wasn't going to snitch, they said, "Okay, you can go." And so by the way, the guard, his name was Garcia. And a couple of years ago, we were doing a show around that area, and he came to the show, the Cheech and Chong show.
Wow!
And he had just gotten out of prison himself.
It just goes to show, don't you? Nobody is protected.
Well,
and off limits.
Oh no, they know. You know, prison guards are notorious because it's for a lot of places, it's the shittiest job you can have. And so they make extra money by dealing drugs and contraband and everything else. You know, I mean that's the way of the world.
What was the key lessons you took from your time in there? Because it must be a real window into like the microcosm of American society, their prison systems, and you obviously see so many people like yourself, so wrongfully sentenced, and in many cases, I imagine for much longer than you were in there. Was there like certain lessons of either positive or negative conclusions that you came away with?
Well, it's all positive because what I did, I made up my mind because it was a bogus charge. Mm-hmm. And so I was going to be a model prisoner because I was going to show the authorities first of all, that marijuana is not addicting. And so when they tried to, they tried to set me up right off the bat. They had people offer me weed. And the reward was that if I took the bait, they would get time off their sentence. That's the way it works. And so everybody, I had two or three offers a day. And Steve was a good help because Steve would just shoo them away. He was like my bodyguard. But I could have gotten high the first day I was in there at a one, but I also got drug tested.
And every day afterwards, yeah, right?
Drug tested almost constantly, because they were looking for, because they knew, everybody knew that I was a bum rap. Everybody knew. And the prisons know. And the thing is, here's a lesson I learned with prisons. It's separate from the judicial system, totally. When the judge sentenced someone to jail, that's the end of the judicial process.
Yep.
Once you get into the prison thing, it's worse, well, about the same as a communist country, because you have absolutely no rights whatsoever. And what they would do, they would take people on what they call diesel therapy. Have you ever heard that line?
No. Diesel it sounds therapy. Ominous, though.
What it is, in fact, they did it to this one guy. We called him Mr. Clean. He was a little Jewish guy that was in there for some kind of medical device law that they somehow inadvertently broke something. It wasn't financial. It was about the unlawful advertisement or something. I don't know exactly what it was, but the guy, you talk about guys that, me, you know, come on, I had a prison tattoo even before I went to prison. You know, I hung out at my house in Calgary was like a halfway house for people getting out of prison because they had nowhere to go. And you know, my mom was very hip about it. And I think because my aunt had done time in jail. So I was definitely a guy that had, you know, was destined to either visit or be in the prison. But Mr. Clean, as we call him, he was the opposite. This guy was sheltered. He had a phobia. He had a phobia against Black people, I guess. And because the first time I met Mr. Clean, he was on the phone. There's a whole bunch of where you phone. There's a phone, rows of phone on either side of the room. The whole room is like people on the phone. Well, there are two Black guys. They're just talking to each other. You know, hey, man, you know, and the Black guys would talk not only loud, at a distance. They wouldn't go up next to each other and talk. They would yell across the room, hey, motherfucker, you know, they'd be betting. In fact, they were talking about the Lakers and the Houston Rockets. The Lakers lost for the first time and Houston won, and they were yelling about that. Well, the little Mr. Clean, the little Jewish guy, put his hand on the phone. He turned around. He said, "Will you guys shut up?" Now, these are big Black convicts, and they not used to being, you know, because in prison making eye contact can be an insult.
Yeah looking telling at somebody the wrong way, yeah,
telling someone to shut up, especially to their face, you know, will you guys shut up? And everybody was shocked. Well, the Black guys, They were sharp, but they kind of chuckled because they knew, you know, they could kill this guy if they wanted to. But they also knew that if they even looked like they were going to be violent, they would end up in the hole right away. You know, yeah. This is prison. So anyway, I got to know Mr. Clean quite well, because in the morning when we, before we did our chores, we'd all meet together, like a little group, do the count, everybody here, okay, and then we'd separate to go to our various jobs. My job was sweep, eventually. I didn't have to work, but I wanted to work. I wanted to do the whole experience. And I realized in my head, the way to do it is to concentrate on whatever you're doing and do the best job you can. Well, usually when you sweep, the whole idea is you check out a little dustbin and a broom. and then you walk over to the pool room and you lay it against the pool room. Then you go and play pool all day or until the count. And then you, at the end of the day, you pick up your broom and your dustbin and you bring it back to where you got it from and check it back in. Well, I was one of the only ones, not the only one, but one of the only ones that took my job serious. So I would be out and I'd find areas and I'd sweep. Sweeping is very, very meditative, you know.
I find ironing is that too. I love ironing. Just get lost in the task.
Yeah, you get, but sweeping too. Now you're making a difference. You're cleaning, you're sweeping. And so I used to sweep those sidewalks almost too clean. And I got to the point where guys, there was little areas where they'd smoke and throw their cigarette butts on the ground. I really got to the area where I'd wait for them to throw their cigarette butts and then sweep it up. It was, and the thing is, everybody leaves you alone. That's another lesson that you don't get on the outside. You know, if I were to try to do anything, the only thing I did on the inside that created interest was I would practice my tango walk. I think I put that in the book. I would practice my tango walk.
That's how you and Steve get to know each other, right? You grab him and you say, "Let's go dancing."
yeah. That's and that was the only time that I created a crowd, you know. But the sweeping, it gave me satisfaction, and so now at home, that's my job.
It's a prison house train, you told me.
yeah. I make my bed. I sweep the grounds. The only difference is I do it at my leisure, my time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know,
and making the bed and I wash dishes. My wife cooks. I clean up the kitchen after. And you would talk about happy wife. When I do cameos, sometimes I get asked advice, you know, because Shelby and I have been together forever.
What year did you get married, Tommy?
I'm guessing it was in the 80s. I think 88, something like that.
Wow. So, yeah, you're coming up on kind of 40 years.
Yeah.
Half your life. That's amazing.
She vowed she would never marry me. She was my girlfriend, and she would never. She never wanted to be a wife. She said because she just didn't believe in marriage until the accountant or the lawyers told her that if you're not married to me, and anything happens to me, she doesn't get anything. She'd be written out of the will.
She's like, when can we book the reception?
That's exactly it. What happened? She said, okay. I'm going to marry you, but you have to do everything. I had to get the priest. I had to do everything, and we did get married. but it's happy wife, and that's what prison. You know, I really did learn habits that I never had before. You know,
I guess it humbled you big time as well, right?
Humbled. Yes. Yeah. I wasn't that cocky, you know, out before that, you know, like I know that if Cheech ever got incarcerated, he would have a hard time. He would have a very hard time. One time we did get busted in Tampa, Florida for obscenity. And they had Cheech in a holding cell, both of us. And Cheech did not like the feeling at all. His dad was a cop at one time.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
Cheech played a cop on television. And so the last thing cops want to do is end up in jail. And when we were in jail, he was very uncomfortable. Well, at first he was funny. And he was teasing the guard. Oh, jail 10D, he was acting gay. He said, "Oh, jail 10D, can we have some pink toilet tissue, please?" You know, and the guard would ignore him. And then a couple of hours went by, the guard comes up and points to Cheech and says, "You come with me."
Amazing. That put the fear of God into him.
Oh, you should have seen the look on his face. What? Oh, okay. Then I heard him talking. You know, my dad's a cop. Yeah, LAPD.
As trying to bro down.
Because we got in the elevator and you could see all the dents in the elevator, metal sheet, but you see where people have fought, you know, some brawls, you see face implants all through there. So, and it was Tampa, Florida, so it was the South. It was, everything worked out okay, but it was quite an experience.
When came out the gate, Tommy, when you're first doing Cheech and Chong, are the authorities coming after you then? You know, because you're obviously like from the get go, you guys are taking stabs at, you know, the system and authority and, you know, you're ridiculing and showing the hypocrisy of these people. Were you kind of public enemy number one from the start? Or
not with the local cops, because especially L.A. loved, all the cops loved this.
They did.
Cheech's dad became a big celebrity in the cop world because his son was Cheech. And Vanity Fair wanted to do an exclusive on me going to jail.
Yeah.
So they hired a writer and a limousine to take me to prison. And we're driving in the limousine and the limo driver was speeding. And so we got pulled over by the highway patrol. But as soon as they got pulled over, the guy says, "I'm taking Tommy Chong to prison." The guy's, "Oh, Tommy Chong, okay.
No problem. On your way."
On your way, yeah. Yeah.
It's wild. What a magical time. Was the chemistry immediate with you two? Or was it something you had to work at? Or was it just there from the moment you first hooked up and started jamming ideas?
Well, the very first time I met him, I didn't know what he was. You know, a mutual friend had got us together because I was looking for one more guy in my improv group. And he said, "This guy's pretty funny." And so I went to meet him. And there was something very organic about everything, you know, very serendipity. When we met, we looked at each other and he couldn't figure out what I was and I couldn't figure out what he was. And I didn't know really that he was Mexican until we ended up in Los Angeles, because he became a landed immigrant in Canada, and Cheech is one of those chameleons. You know, he can just, wherever he's at, he can become part of that environment. And like he did in Calgary, he went to Calgary to work with a potter, a guy throwing pots and making ceramics.
How's he
doing? Well, he did really well. And then he went to on a vacation to Banff, and he'd never been in the mountains or in snow before in his life. And so they take him up to the top of the mountain and put on some skis and send him down the hill, and he compound fractured one of his legs. And so he was on the crutches for about a year, and healing in that. And that's how he ended up in Vancouver. He was a meditator too. And so he joined a meditation group, and they were out in Vancouver. That's why he ended up in Vancouver area. But when we met, I wasn't impressed until he showed up at the club, because I was kind of smiling because I knew what he did for a living and I knew how much he got paid, which was nothing. And in fact, he had to deliver carpets on the side to make some money. He was a laborer with a college aspirations, you know. And so so when he came to see us, to see the club, the thing, he made an entrance. He came in with this gorgeous woman with a full length mink coat on, and gorgeous lady. And Cheech was all decked up, you know, nice duds, you know, and he looked like he owned the place.
Presented himself like a pimp. Yeah.
Yeah. He looked like he owned every room he walked into. And everybody in the acting troupe, they were kind of, oh, that's the guy, huh? Okay. Well, then he joined up, and he sort of like was very quiet. He said he joined up as a writer, but he joined up as an actor, not a writer. Although he would take part in the group, the improv group thing. It was when we got fired. My brother, we had to stop doing the experiment because we were losing too much money. And so my brother said, we got to go back to the girls. And in other words, my acting chops were over. And Cheech was the only one that wanted to keep doing it, you know, because he was getting into it, getting into the acting thing, and he was enjoying it. And working with beautiful girls, you know, that stripped down every night. It wasn't too hard to take either, you know, but all the other actors, you know, they're ready to quit, go back doing, you know, dancing on stage and doing the doorman stuff and that. But Cheech and I were the only ones that, so we put a band together, and we had a drummer and an organ player, and because that was usually, you know, that was my gig usually, used to be anyway, but when we went to our first gig, it was a battle of the bands. And when we got on stage, we started doing comedy, and the crowd all gathered, came forward, sat down, just dug the hell out of our comedy. So much so, we never played a note. We never went to the music.
Amazing.
And that night, that was the day. That day was when we created Cheech and Chong. You know, driving home, we were saying, well, what are we going to call ourselves? Tommy and Richard? Nah. Marin and Chong? Nah. I said, do you have a nickname? He said, yeah, Cheech. I said, Cheech and Chong.
A bit of alliteration, rolls off the tongue. It's perfect, isn't it?
And a linguist from UCLA once walked with us and said, it's very interesting how you took a first name and a last name and you put them together. And it's, she told us how, and, you know, interesting and wonderful and strange and everything else. And then as soon as we figured out our name, we played one blues club to make sure that we could, you know, our act would go really well in a small club as well as a big venue. And then I told Cheech, I said, we got to go to L.A. And Cheech had just escaped from the state. So he had to sneak back in. And no one expected the Mexican to sneak in from Canada. So
yeah, right. It's amazing. Then,
yeah, back then you could, the border was basically open. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no 9/11. There's no restrictions, you know. It depended on, you know, the time of day, and people were so lax, you know. And so Cheech actually used another guy's ID and got through the border. And then we, you know, tripped around. I kind of knew L.A. because I'd played music in Los Angeles at a couple of clubs. And so I knew the black scene. And they were the only ones that would hire. They'd have a floor show, and they would hire comics, and they would hire dancers. And so when Cheech and I, we went to Red Fox Club, was the opening. Our first gig was at the Red Fox Club, where we met the Lenny Bruce entourage. Lenny had died years earlier, and this whole entourage was just looking for someone to follow. And so one of them, Tony Pescara, he ended up, He was our advisor more than anything, because he had a heroin habit, and so he was effective on certain days and not effective most of the time. And so Tony and I became really good friends. Not Cheech, amazing, you know, that Tony, being a Chicano, you would think he would hobnob with Cheech, but Cheech was a bit too young, and I was the main guy, you know, the writer and everything. And so Tony and I became really good friends. And I asked him a lot about Lenny, you know, and he helped our show. What he was more than anything, he was like our truth teller, you know. Like we'd do a gig somewhere, you know, opening for some act, and we'd almost get a standing ovation. They loved us so much. But Tony would always shoot us down. He'd say, you entertain a crowd, big deal. And I'd say, well, when do you think, and when can we say we made it, Tony? He says, when those people line up outside the club are there to see you, not somebody else, you know. And eventually that day came about, and I remember what Tony said. And at the end of Tony's life, by that, you know, we'd done all the records, and we'd been on tour for 7 years, and then we started doing movies. And then when I did Nice Dreams, I hired Tony as a writer, and so I got him a nice. Actually, I guess I was kind of responsible for his demise too, because he had a steady paycheck coming in.
Right.
And
yeah.
And he was just buying crap with it, you know, buying the junk with it. But Tony was very funny. He'd been around Lenny enough, and he was very, very cool, very smart guy, very hip. Yeah, I learned a lot off Tony. He was a real Pachuco, real low rider, you know. Cheech was a college kid, you know, and Tony was the real deal. And so Tony and I really got along good, you know, because we're basically the same kind of upbringing then. And Tony had some funniest bits ever. I got him to write a script. In fact, I still got the script somewhere where he'd been busted many times, and part of his thing, see, back in the day, they didn't want to put junkies in jail. You know, they would do everything they could to keep them from putting in jail, because you're putting a sick guy into a prison.
Yeah.
And they're going to be sick, and they're going to be useless, you know, and especially if they don't have their stuff, you know, they're going to be horribly sick. And so the judge didn't want to put Tony in jail, and so they would keep. So he had one job. He was like the night caretaker at a mental home for rich people, you know. Like Reagan had shut down all the mental homes, and so if you had a problem, they had this motel that was just strictly for people that have mental issues, you know. And these people weren't locked in. They could go, come and go as they please, but they were crazy. And so Tony wrote a whole book about them. I got the book. And I try to do a little bit in Nice Dreams, mm-hmm. where we're at a mental home. I just touched on a little bit of what Tony was telling me. Oh, my God. His stories, because he was really a comedic genius, because he would. His job in the hospital or the halfway house or what do you want to call it, was dispensing medication. Now it's a job for a junkie, huh? and the people that were waiting for their drugs would line up, and Tony would be torturing him, reading a book, and as soon as it got to the time. I think it was 12 noon is when Tony had to do it. The guys in front, they knew better, but as soon as it got close to 12, they would start fidgeting because they're crazy, you know, as well as they needed. And they would clear their throat and make noise. And then when it got almost 12, and Tony would let it go past 12, and they would be panicking. Tony, it's time, Tony, it's time, Tony. And so Tony just look at the clock, just torture, you know. He get up, make a move, then he goes to the bathroom. Just torture the hell out of him. But that was Tony. But there was one guy in the place called First. His thing was, he had to be the first. So if you walked in, he'd be the first to greet you. Yep. And he was the He was the first to get his medication. He was the first to go to bed, first to get up, first to eat supper. He had that phobia. And so Tony did a whole line on Mr. First. And then he had another one, this Lucy. Lucy was this very beautiful, I think she was like a rich heiress, you know, but she was crazy. And she was always pretending, or in her mind, she was pregnant. And she'd have a little doll, and she'd have it under her dress. And, I think my water broke. And then she would do this, and then all of a sudden the doll would come out. And that would be her baby. It was, they had all these crazies in there.
It's like one for Over the Cuckoo's Nest, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. That's what it was. And so Tony wrote that. I got the script here somewhere. And now I think my plan now is to end the career with a movie company.
Right.
I want to form a movie. I think I told you this. I want to form a movie company. And,
like a production company?
No, actually, it'll be a movie company that hires production companies. Right. I want to be the mogul. See, and I'll have. And the only thing I need will be unlimited funds for the budgets, and that's why I'm on starting a program where I want to become the richest man in the world. You know, everybody laughs, but it's so you can put your mind to anything; it can happen.
Yeah,
especially if my motives are right, and my motives are right, because I want to become the richest man in the world, because I want to be able to fund projects that last years, not just months or a couple of years. But I want to do a project where it goes for 10 years. And the project is going to be, you know, that immigration, the lineup we had from South America, the migration, where everybody had a caravan from South America, and they walked, literally walked from Guatemala and El Salvador, carrying babies and kids, and they walked 1,300 miles or 1,400 miles to get to the border and to be turned back or be separated from your family. What I want to do is hire the marchers with my movie company and get them visas to come in and give them jobs in the movie company as extras or maids or whatever their abilities are. And then I want to put the kids through school and acting school if they so desire, you know, performance schools, and I want to be able to build villages for these for the immigrants, and then assimilate them all. And then I want to show the world how we can use the movie industry to create a society that is without greed and that kind of thing. You know, we can do that. Especially in America, because our laws are perfect for it, and so that's my aim to do this, and you know, that's going to be my life's work from here on down.
And what could be more countercultural and based on pure love and positive energy than that as well? You know, because obviously, historically speaking, Hollywood is the very institution of greed, isn't it? And to flip that on its head and go, well, actually, we can do all these amazing things with this instead.
Yeah. Because the Hollywood system's perfect. I mean, when they shot the Ten Commandments, Cecil B. DeMille, they literally hired the Egyptian army as cast members. It can be done, and it took years. Of course, it went over budget. A lot of that was publicity, you know. Elizabeth Taylor demanded so much money, blah blah blah, you know. I want to show the world that, see, Trump inspired me when he tried to overthrow the government. What he had, what everybody did, because everybody did naturally, everybody's got a cell phone. And on the cell phone is a movie camera. And so everybody took movies of themselves. Now, it's going to be used against them in court for the most part, or used for them in court, you know, if they weren't violent and they got video to prove it, you see. And so what I envision now is, especially when I talk to the marchers, I'm going to be able to get the video that they shot, you know, because you know they did. You know, you do it automatically. You got a cell phone, you're going to record everything. And so I want to gather all that video footage that they have and turn it over to the editors and then you know, cast certain people. And what I want to do is videotape the process, you see. And I also got a plan too for the farm workers, because I got a plan where we hire the farm workers as the movie project, and they're paid by the movie actors, and then we'll job them out to the farmers themselves, although we will be paying them for the movie, and the farmers will be paying them for their labor, and the farmers will be forced to pay them decent wage for the work, because it's going to be documented, and the health care and all that stuff that comes with it, you know, accommodations, health care, and visas, work visas, you know, for these very essential workers, you know. So I envision the camera being used in so many positive ways, you know, because what's happening in America right now, and I think Trump's a good product of what happened, is that the greed has overtaken the sensibilities or the decency of the Republicans, for sure. And
it's profits like over people, isn't it? Now that's clearly all it's about.
Yeah, and the thing is, when you start getting that kind of craziness, you know, that love of gold, you know, the Bible always says, you know, root of all evil is money. When you get caught up into that system, there's no end to it. Yeah. You can never make enough money, and it's a sickness. And so what I want to do is document all that sickness and talk about it, you know, and then have it. And then the other thing,
and deconstruct it and flip it. And I love it.
Yeah. And then have my own channel. That's another thing too, that it's available now. I right now, if I want to, I could buy, there's so many channels that are available, you know, because they're not making it. I want to have my own Tommy Chong channel, so that I don't have to go to Netflix or anybody else. I'm going to be showing my product on my TV. So there's no what ifs, or maybe we should, you know, sponsor, where none of that crap, you know. And if I do that, I know that I could very well become the richest man in the world. And if I do that, the way, especially at my age too, because like with Christmas coming, you know, people say, what do you want for Christmas? I don't want anything. You know, I've been on the planet long enough. I got everything I need. And so I always tell people, you know, they don't know what to buy me. I say, well, then just buy me a book. Find a book that you think I might like. I got a shitload of books that I have.
You can never have too many books, right? It's just the time to read them all.
yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so I can see myself. And once you steer people into the right area, you know, like Elon Musk has done that, and I wish Bezos of Amazon, I wish he had more thing, or Bill Gates, or any of those .comers, you know, because yeah. what happened to these guys? They get so wealthy that they get paralyzed. Mm-hmm. They can't move. They don't know what to do. They move, you know, because the money's coming in from both angles, every angle. You know, it's like an avalanche, like a flood, You know, they don't know what to do. And so you got people hired, you know, to move the money around or to hide it or to make more money and or to steal it. Yeah, you know damn well, every all these rich people, there's people embezzling the shit out of there.
Yeah.
Out of them because they got so much money coming in. They're never going to miss it. But yet, I've been around them. And yet, these are the same people that will walk, park their car on the street and walk a couple of blocks just so they don't have to pay the parking attendant,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
Or they'll take a bill and they'll go through the bill to make sure that, oh, tips included. Don't worry. Don't give a tip. Tips included. You know what I mean?
It's really funny that the wealthiest are often the tightest.
Yeah.
I didn't finish the book, Tommy. I've got about 20 pages left. But do you talk in the book about, or did I read this somewhere else? Did you share a cell with Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street dude?
I did. Yeah.
What was he like?
He was great. He's a genius. But you know, just on the wrong path.
Yeah.
You know, that's all. Greed. And more than anything, his problem was he was addicted to Quaaludes.
Right, that was his.
Even in his movie. Yeah, he was addicted to Quaaludes. Cocaine, he tried cocaine. He did cocaine and debauchery, you know. And he paid for it all. The Wolf of Wall Street in the movie, it shows you how he paid a price for it all, you know. But I tried to hook up with him later. A friend of my wife's is... she's connected to the Bidens and everybody, Lynette, and she was really connected to Hunter Biden and his art, you know. Well, Lynette found out about me and Jordan right away. She goes, let's have a dinner.
Reunion. Where are they now?
yeah. Well, let's have a reunion. And I want to do a documentary of Jordan. And so I said, okay. So Jordan and I got together again, you know. He was a genius. He always had a couple of guys around him. He'd be playing backgammon with one, talking to him. You know, he can do a lot of multitasker. He knows how to fly a helicopter. He took lessons and he learned how to fly a helicopter. And he's purchased one of the largest boats only to have sunk in the Mediterranean. His life is just one adventure after another. But he's still got that whatever it is. I'm guessing. I know he's got the same problem that a lot of people have, the short man problem, you know. No matter how much money he's got, it's not going to put any height to him, you know. And rather than to be comfortable with it, he's kind of has a chip on his shoulder, you know. But like I say, he is a genius. He was in, I think he finished high school when he was like 13, something like that. And he was ready to go to university and become a doctor. And he told me this out of his own lips. He said they had everybody in the auditorium and the dean of the school got up and he said, listen, if you're here to make a lot of money, get up and leave now. And Jordan got up and left. He did not want to become a doctor. He wanted to become wealthy. And he did. And had he used his genius in a positive way, he'd be like Elon Musk, you know. That's where he's at. But because he used it in a very negative and sort of a selfish kind of way. But his stories were incredible, man. Every night it was like, can you imagine? Every night I'd get a new adventure of the Jordan. And he was like Bonfires of the Vanity, you know, that book.
Yeah.
And he was that guy, you know. He was that guy. He's a very cool guy. I haven't talked to him for a while. But when he got out of jail, he pulled his car in front of my house because we were both on probation. We couldn't hobnob with each other, you know. That's a no-no. So he yells from the car. He goes, I sold my book. Yeah, I wrote a book. I sold it. Martin Scorsese's going to make a movie. I sold Wolf of Wall Street, and I'm up in my balcony. Yay! Way to go, Jordan! Way to go! Yeah, it was quite a guy. My wife, he was very charming. My wife every woman that meets him, they like him right away. He's got that boyish charm, you know. Mm-hmm. And he's got a lot of money, and that's very attractive to women too.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's amazing. I mean, out of all the great storytellers and adventurers that you've met and spent time with, who for you has just been like, maybe from a fan point of view or just, you know, in an admiration point of view, who's like the greatest raconteur you think you've come into contact with in, you know, in your incredibly rich and varied life? Is there one that stands out above the rest or a couple? Just like a proper modern day Renaissance man?
Well, you know, I guess it would have to be, like, for a while there was Lou Adler. You know, yeah. He was the record guy that made Cheech and Chong, basically took Cheech and Chong, put us on the map. But before Lou Adler, I'd known Berry Gordy, Motown. And so Berry Gordy, he was the one that got me started being Chong and Cheech and Chong.
Was your band the first interracial band on Motown? Am I right in thinking that?
That's right. We were the first interracial. With white guys, with me, well, near white, me. halfway, they kind of eased into it.
And the original name of that band, is that right that you were going to go down that avenue? That's so funny.
Isn't that great? Isn't
Four
that
N's great? And a C.
Yeah, you can't say that anymore. That was way before the rappers, way before anybody.
Outrageous, yeah.
Outrageous, yeah. I met Muhammad Ali too, and he was a great inspiration. Nelson Mandela was another. I never met Nelson, but when I went to jail, I kept thinking Nelson did 18 years, man. I can do 9 months.
Yeah. That's a freedom fighter right there, isn't it?
Yeah. I was involved with discovering the Jackson Five. And so
how did that come about? Tell us that story if you wouldn't mind.
We had a gig. We were on the Chitlin circuit with the Does Your Mama Know About Me, my song. And we were playing in Chicago. And we double billed with Jerry Butler. And there was Jerry Butler, the Vancouvers, or Four Ends in the Sea. A group from Gary, Indiana called the Jackson 5 Plus Johnny. That was the name of their billing. And they had won a contest, a high school contest. And the winner of the contest got to open for Jerry Butler and Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers. And that wasn't the first two either. Cheech and I once... We had a thing, but anyway, the Jackson Five. So we heard Michael for the first time, saw him, the little guy. He was short for his age. He grew up later, but he was a tiny little guy when we met him. And sing his ass off, dance his ass off. And he had that high voice, little guy. He was an adult, actually, when we met him, because he dressed like an adult, acted like an adult, little hat, little everything. And the older he got, the younger he got.
Yeah.
And when he died, he was like a little kid. You know?
It's a strange, strange story, that one, isn't it, how that panned out? But then, so did you go to Barry and say, this is this group you should check out, or?
Well, I never. Bobby Taylor, it was his apartment that they stayed in.
Right.
And so Bobby said to them all, Joe, well, come to Detroit, man. I'll get you signed with Motown. And so they stayed at Bobby's house or apartment for about a month, a good month.
Well, the whole family.
Well, except for the women.
Yeah.
The girls stayed in Gary, but all the boys and Joe were there. And when the Motown gave them their contract, Joe brought the contract to me because I was the only white guy or the near white guy that he knew. Bobby Taylor and Joe showed up with a contract. What do you think? And I took the contract. He says, feels good to me. Handed it back. Now, think, you know, retrospect, we could have went to Barry and said, listen, we're managing this group. And I think they would make it a nice home here. But see, I was never, it was never about money. It was all about making it individually, you know.
That was your trip, was it?
Is that
why you wound up leaving the group and going off and doing your own thing, is because you wanted to forge your own path?
Eventually, I got fired from the group.
Right.
You know, and then when Barry found out about it, he called me up and he says, Tom, it's been a mistake. You're not fired. And I told Barry, I said, you know what? I think I'm going to stay fired. I told Barry, I want to become a Barry Gordy. I don't want to work for one. And Barry says, I can appreciate that. So he gave me a nice severance bump and off to California. And I stayed in California for a while with my girlfriend and then eventually my wife. I had my dual job happening there for a while. And then I had to go to Vancouver because of the clubs. The clubs were kind of having a problem. And so
this is another thing that I read, is you started the first strip club in all of Canada. Is that right?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Oh, Western Canada for sure. I don't know about the rest. Yeah. Oh no, I think all of Canada, I think, because Canada is very puritanical. And we did it with body painting. It was body painted, the naked body. And then after that, the
psychedelic strip joints. Love it.
Well, when they found out, you know, it was a purity. Canada's very purity, you know, very church oriented. And that's why they had a Sunday law, you know, you couldn't drink or everything had to close down on Sunday. And it still does in Canada. And the government controlled the alcohol, you know, and that's what they're doing now with the weed. You know, I can't have my weed up in Canada because of a celebrity law. And, you know, they're looking right at me when they said that no celebrity endorsements, which makes no sense whatsoever. You know, it's a medicine. But we'll fix that coming up. But, yeah, Motown. Yeah, Barry Gordy was the guy that got it. And when I got to Vancouver, I really tried to be a songwriter, but, you know, for some reason, I was a bodybuilder, you know. And so, and when you think of it, you know, everything was heading toward Up in Smoke, the movie, our live performances, you know, and all the clubs, Cheech and Chong, we kept entertaining everybody, and then. But I always wanted to do movies, you know, that was my whole goal. And so I wrote a movie first, and then Cheech and Lou said, well, you know, Lou said, okay, I'll get you a movie deal. And then Lou not only got us a movie deal, but he got himself a job as a director. And we tried another director, but it didn't work, you know. And so Lou, actually, I directed it and wrote it. And Lou was sort of like he did with the records, you know. Lou never wrote anything, but he would arrange and produce. He was a great producer. And so we'd do a bit, send it to Lou. Lou would listen to it, send it back with some notes. Hey, it's good. How about this? How about that? Always suggestions. And then we would take it and change it however we wanted to change it. So Lou Adler was a big, big influence on that one, especially with the movie.
And yeah, so I mean, he was just a king of that scene as well, wasn't he, at that time? He had his fingers in so many of the most exciting projects.
The only thing, he wanted to call it Cheech and Chong's Greatest Hits because he wanted to put his records in there somehow, you know. But I went home and I wrote a song, Up in Smoke. And one night, you know, I sat at home and diddled, and probably the best song I've ever written. Oh, Does Your Mama Know About Me is up there too. But Up in Smoke was quite a thing, because when I sang it for Lou and Cheech, Cheech says, I got to put the Mexican stamp on it, but that's the title of the movie. And sure enough, that was the title of the movie. Yeah.
Tommy, I've got to tell you, as we approach the end, this has been amazing. And thank you so much for, you know, your time and sharing your story so generously. My introduction to you, which I wanted to share with you, is National Lampoon's Senior Trip, which is a strange one. But I was a kid and I remember I got switched onto that, and you were the bus driver, Red. And you'd be like, that's why they call me Red, man. I'm immune. And I just remember laughing so much. I was only about 11 or 12 when I first saw that film. And that was my introduction to the, you know, the Tommy Chong character. And I was like, this is incredible. And then I went and, you know, checked out Up in Smoke and all the others. But it was National Lampoon's Senior Trip as Red, the bus driver. And then you party to death. You pass out on the bus, and the kids have, this is him, man. It's Red King. Did you have a good time on that shoot? Do you remember that?
It was the first time that I'd gone away from Cheech, you know, and I had my son with me, you know, and Paris, he had a tiny little bit in there. I wanted to be more into the, well, you know, my wife actually wanted to take Paris with you, and I wanted to get more Paris in there. But yeah, you know, I really enjoyed it. I learned a lot. And the one actor, what's his name? Hurt Locker.
Yeah, Jeremy Renner, is it? Is that his name?
Yeah. He was a star of the Senior Trip.
And there's a couple of the guys from like Kids in the Hall, and it had a really interesting cast.
Yeah, they had. They were trying everybody. Yeah, they were trying everything. I really enjoyed it. There was one thing. It was that when I came up with a bus, and the bus skidded into the thing.
Yeah.
You know, well, they did that with a K. I didn't know how they would do that, but they hooked the cable up to the axle, and so when the bus came around there, they just it looked like the bus did it themselves, but they used a tractor and they pulled that rear end of the bus around. It was such a good entrance, you know.
It's amazing.
And that was probably the only other thing. At the end of the movie, they paid like 10 grand to have me back to raise my fist, you know. Mm-hmm. But I was covered. And you know, at the time, that was the first non-Cheech and Chong movie that I did. You know, we're right on the top. So I said to the director, I says, you're not going to see my face? He said, no, just a hand. I said, well, it can be any hand, right? And he said, yeah. I said, okay. But so put someone else in there, you know. Yeah. Now, I don't know if you want to call that ego or what, but I'm a director too.
Yeah.
You know? And so you never use an actor when you can use a stand-in or someone else, you know, because you never know what's going to happen to the actor, you know. So that was the only thing. I never did it. I don't know. I never heard from those guys again, you know, so obviously it was a one and done situation.
I think that movie is one of the most underrated teen comedies ever. I think it's so good, but it's a proper cult, like, underground film that so few people, certainly in the UK, like, so few people know about it. But you even get in the Earache in My Eye. You get in the song, don't you, in the movie as well? Mama talking to me, trying to tell me how to live. That's in that film, too. That was the first time I heard that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Mama talking. Yeah, it's in the movie. I got to see those movies again. I watched The Corsican Brothers. I was doing a signing up in St. Louis Obispo last weekend. And they had Corsican Brothers on the big screen. I could hardly sign. I'm watching The Corsican Brothers.
Total memory lane.
Oh, man. On the high definition, that looked incredible. The costumes and the sword fighting. And, you know, it looked like it was like a well-done sword fighting, swashbuckling movie.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up with those movies.
Errol Flynn style.
Yeah. Yeah, I grew up with those. And I looked at that and I thought, oh, shit. But that was the movie that broke Cheech and I up, you know. Cheech did not want to do the movie.
How long were you kind of, you know, what would the term be? Estranged from each other.
Estranged. We were estranged after that movie. Almost 7 years, something like that. Maybe longer. We got back together in 2008. And
okay.
That movie happened in Corsican Brothers was 81. And so we'd been apart from 81 until 08.
So there wasn't any, that's like 27 years. So that, was there much like personal, you know, private interaction, or was it literally just
the only interaction we had? See, Cheech and I, when we split, we differed on so many things, you know. I loved doing stand-up. He had no interest in doing stand-up. So when we split, I ended up doing stand-up. And then I ended up having my wife do stand-up with me. She became my partner. And, or at least co-stars, you know. She would do her own bit, and I'd do my bit. And then we danced together. And, it wasn't until around 07. Actually, we tried to get together 03, and then I got put in jail, and that stopped everything. We were going to get together to do a movie, another movie in 03, but instead I went to jail, and then I
did
got
he
out.
Reach out to you around that time, though? Is he like a friend? He was there?
We'd always been tight. When I started doing stand-up, I stole a bit from Sam Kennison. Mm-hmm. Sam used to have a telephone handy, and he'd tell some guy.
Your girlfriend's, you know, on the phone, right?
Yeah, your girlfriend. Get her on the phone. Hey, you bitch, you cunt, you whore.
You'd do that, but with Cheech, would you?
No, what I'd do, I'd say, I'd phone Cheech up. Cheech, everybody wants to say hi, Cheech. Everybody, I'd hold the phone up. Everybody, hi, Cheech, you know? And I just let him, you know, and sometimes I'd wake him up. And then he started making noises like he wanted to get paid. and so I quit that bit.
it's funny, isn't it, when you're part of a double act, like, it's such a unique relationship. It's kind of like, you know, you're bound for the rest of your lives, whether you want to be or not. You are. And obviously you've done so many fantastic things together, but...
Yeah, he's in Winnipeg right now shooting a movie with Woody Harrelson.
Nice.
Cheech was torn, you know, because he wasn't thrilled doing the Chicano, you know, the lowrider, you know. In fact, he only did it really one time, you know. The Up in Smoke was the only time. Everywhere else he's away from that character until we did the Corsican Brothers. Then it was a total thing, total departure for both of us. And that was our swan song that we ended up. The problem with Cheech, like Cheech says, you know, I always wanted to keep the act together again. But the problem was, is that whenever I would write anything, I'd make him the star. You know, he was a star. And Up in Smoke, you can basically say he was the star of the show. And Nice Dreams and all the rest, you know, he was front and center. It wasn't until we got to the Corsican Brothers that he didn't want to do it. And then he wanted to be a Spanish character, you know, that we go our separate ways. And then he comes back, he's been to Spain, and now he's Spanish, and I'm like a revolutionary, you know. And then we got together in Aspen. It was the first time Cheech and I just got out of jail. And so they wanted me in Aspen and Cheech, and they were paying a special tribute to Jim Carrey. And so they wanted Cheech and I to perform. And so Cheech had been Don Johnson for years. And so Cheech, you know, I had no problem. Cheech said, so what do you, he didn't really say, what do you want to do? He was actually that character. And so I said to him, I said, well, let's do Harry and Margaret. Now, Harry and Margaret, Cheech puts on a wig, and he's a woman. He doesn't have one word. He just looks at me, you know, when I'm describing a porno movie. Mm-hmm. And so I said, well, let's do Harry and Margaret. Cheech, he didn't want to do it. He did not want to become Cheech. And so we went on stage, and so we started, because I'd been doing stand-up for years, I had an act. And so I did my act. And in the act, I kind of knocked him and Don Johnson. You know, I sing Up in Smoke, you know, and then I make up lyrics, you know, where you go to the record store, you know, Blockbusters, rent a Cheech and Chong tape, get back home, smoke a big doobie. You forget you got the tape, you end up watching the Discovery Channel. And it's a show about two frogs fucking. And you start thinking, gee, Cheech looks funny without a mustache. And who's that frog fucking him? It looks like Don Johnson. Then you bring the tape back a month later, you bring it back and pay $100. And Cheech was on stage all the time and singing that, and he's behind me. And he was like, he didn't know what to do. He was trapped. He was like in a cage, and he's walking back and forth. It was so funny. But I realized now, you know, that he really wanted to become an actor. That was his thing. He wanted to become an actor. He wanted to be able to do other characters. He didn't want to be, you know, buttonholed into that one character. Now, me, on the other hand, I love my character. I still do. You know, that's the same, you know, the version of it for that 70s show, you know. Yeah. And, well, Red was really a version of Chong, you yeah. know, only he's a big old bus driver. So I, you know, and then I also realized that, you know, I have the advantage I had beside my height was the fact that I am a musician, you know, I am a songwriter, I am all of that, you know. I've done it on my own with other people, you know. And then Cheech, he would like to say, you know, that, but you gotta put in the years of playing guitar, you know, before you reach this this status, you know. Because and not only years, but hours and hours of, on stage, you know, under every circumstances in the world. Like, I just watched a documentary of ZZ Top.
Yeah, know? Little old band from Texas.
Yeah, and I love
it.
But all the documentaries I watch, Gordon Lightfoot, ZZ Top, all that, hours and hours and hours of, and it's not slogging away, it's you're having fun.
Yeah.
So much fun, you don't want to stop playing. When I was a kid, I used to sometimes have to bring my amp on the bus in Calgary and then walk a couple of blocks with the amp and the guitar, and get up to my friend's house. We're going to spend the night, and we would literally play guitars until we went to bed. And then when we woke up, we'd reach over and grab the guitars and start playing again.
Because you loved it. Yeah.
And sometimes we'd pick up the phone a girl, or a girl would phone and say, hey, listen to this, put the phone down. And 3 hours later, you forgot the phone's down, you know, and you're playing, oh, the phone's there. You pick it up, hello, and they're still there. That's the world I came from, you know. And I'm very happy with it.
Dude, it's been an amazing life, and there's plenty more left. You know, obviously, you're telling me earlier on about all the things you still want to do, and I have great faith you'll achieve them. I want to ask you one final question before I let you go, if that's okay. Who's the best person you've ever lit up with? Or your favorite?
Most, probably the most talented and most famous has to be George Harrison.
Amazing.
It has to be the Beatles, yeah. George. And it wasn't an accident. You know, I was in a room once with John Lennon, and he didn't smoke. He was sitting on the floor, actually, in this bedroom. And Rod Stewart came in, and I offered him a toke, this stinky old Mexican weed I had. And Rod turned it down, and then I toked up, and I walked out in the hallway, and I met Jack Nicholson. And of course, I said the stupidest thing you can say to an actor, you know. And he just brushed me aside.
No, I thought Jack would be cool. Was he a little bit standoffish, was he?
Oh, he didn't know who I was, you know. And Jack ended up being very cool, you know. He ended up, but at the time, he didn't know who I was. And I was that bang from hell, anyway.
Yeah.
But George and I, we've had a couple of moments where he played on Basketball Jones. He played the intro to Basketball Jones. In fact, that's another thing I want to do with Cheech and Chong. I want to do a play, and I want to call it Basketball Jones. And I want to do a story about, you know, a guy that had a Basketball Jones, and then do a musical of it. Yeah, I figured that'll be my next to-do thing with Cheech and Chong.
Bump it to the top of the list. Yeah, George Harrison, yeah. Man, I'm going to be watching the Get Back documentary this weekend. I'm yet to see it, but it looks amazing. And he just seemed like a beautiful man, you know, just a sweet, sweet soul.
They had that energy. They had that great energy. Paul, he kind of, you know, he's the only Beatle I haven't met and really got high with. And he's the only Beatle that really was a pothead before anybody else. You know who turned the Beatles on? Did I ever tell you that?
Bob Dylan, right?
Yep, that's Bob. Yeah, good old Bob. Now, Bob, I didn't smoke a joint with Bob, or did we? I think we did. We had a sauna. We did a sauna together, and I think we smoked up in the sauna. Yeah, Cheech and I and Bob. We played basketball one-on-one. And in fact, I blocked one of his shots and put his ass on the ground. Get out of here with that weak shit.
Would you do another book, like about the entirety of your life? Obviously, the I Chong one is very much about the prison experience. Would you do like a more general memoir, or is that not really on the top of the list?
I'm definitely looking at. I'm reading books now, and that's in the back of my head. Yeah, definitely. Oh yeah, yeah. I have to.
So many stories, mate.
I have to, because I owe Shelby a book on her, because she really is my muse, you know. All her life, you know, when I met her, she was 16 years old. She's ended up being my next door neighbor. But we're just friends, you know, and I owned a nightclub, so she would you know, visit me, you know, come to our gigs, and you know, she was like a fan. And then you know, she's so beautiful, you know, we ended up being lovers, and now we've been together ever since. I got to write a book about her because, you see, this weekend, my son took me up to St. Louis Obispo, and I had a sign. I can't drive anymore. You know, my eye, I got bad vision in one eye. And so we had my son's daughter, stepdaughter, you know, in one car, my son and his wife and the kids in another car, but no Shelby. And so I called Shelby, and she's home alone, and she's very lonely. And I could feel it, you know, because we're so together, you know, working everything. And then to be taken apart like that, that's how I felt when Cheech and I left, you know, because I did a movie, what's it called? Far Out Man. And I had Cheech in there, just a little cameo. And just that one little cameo was, oh man, Cheech, we, you know, we should be together. You know, this is so smooth. And but Cheech didn't want to, he'd do the cameo and that's it. So he really wanted to get away from me. But I was but Shelby and I think Shelby might have been one of the reasons that Cheech and I broke up. Because when we did the Corsican Brothers, I put Shelby in and his wife Ricky in the movie, and they were the main the Fifis, and then Cheech and Ricky got divorced right after that movie. So I think I was part of the divorce settlement. I think Ricky got custody of me because that was kind of the end of the Cheech and Chong comedy era, you know.
Well, mate, thank you so much again. This has been great. I'm just, honored to have you on the show. And it's a great love story. And you seem like an amazing couple, an inspiring couple that everybody can aspire to be like and enjoy. When you find a love like that, that's the rarest and specialest of gifts, right? It's incredible.
And it deserves a book. It deserves a book. It deserves. Yeah, I was. Yeah, you know, she was kind of sad. You know, I mean, she's very proud. She's incredible. I mean, her artistry is unbelievable. But she's also a very fragile. You know, and she's been my cheerleader, my rock, my muse, my hairdresser, my designer, my everything. She is, really. There's a song called "You're My Everything." That's her. So you're right. I'll do the book. In fact, I'm going to start that book right now.
I love it. You're a lucky man, Tommy. And I'm a lucky man for getting to hang out with you today. I've loved it. And I hope we can do one of these again sometime. You let me know when the next project's on the horizon and let's reconvene.
Okay. Well, you'll probably read about it. And when you do, hook up. Let's talk again.
Amazing. You're a gent.
Take care.
Thanks, Tommy. Have a great day, brother.
Thank you, brother.
Up in smoke, that's where my money goes. In my lungs, and sometimes up my nose. When troubled times begin to bother me, I take a toke and all my cares go up in smoke.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.